So this is a talk that tends to go over time. So what I will do is I will go reasonably fast in the beginning so that I might actually reach the second, like, last part of the talk. But the problem is that I first have to do some number theory to kind of explain a little bit more about standard zeta functions. So I have to ask, who here are, like, mathematicians who work on number theory? Okay, please help me. Okay. So the majority of you are not. Okay, out goes that plan that I'll start off doing things fast in the beginning. I guess I'll have to do things fast in the end then. Okay, so this is some work that I've been kind of thinking about for a few years, and I kind of consider it in the public domain. So anybody who wants to kind of work on this, like, please go ahead. It's clearly a project in an unfinished project, but I think there's some interesting questions there. Okay, so first I'm going to tell a little bit about the Riemann zeta function. If anything, you'll learn a little bit about Riemann zeta function, which should be kind of, you know, part of your scientific education. And so what is the zeta function? The zeta function, the Riemann zeta function, is, well, you start off with this this infinite sum that just goes over the integers, and s is, you know, naively thought of as a real number, but actually you can think of it as a complex number. And so this summation, you know, if s is if s equals 2, then we know that this is, you know, an expression in involving the number pi. And if, you know, s is, you know, any integer larger, well, any real number larger than 1, then this sum converges. Okay, so that's the easy part. And now, to actually reach the statement of the Riemann hypothesis, you have to kind of take the function as, you know, it is defined by this sum on, you know, the complex plane for cases where the real part of S is larger than 1. And then you, so this sum at face value doesn't make any sense if S equals minus 1 or so. But what you can do is you can take, you know, the way it is defined on the right side of the complex plane, apply standard techniques of analytical continuation, and thereby define it over the whole complex plane. For most of you, this is standard fare. For some of you, it might not. Just think of it the way that if you have this other infinite sum, then, you know, you can write this as this fraction, as we know. But now, what, you know, analytical continuation kind of allows you to do with like lots of epsilons and deltas is that you kind of claim that this is, you know, the function that is defined over the whole complex plane. So you do something similar for this sum. It's not as nice as an expression as it is here, but there is a well-defined function from the complex values to the complex values, and that is the Riemann zeta function. So Riemann showed that such an analytical continuation exists, and that makes sense and so forth. And so, having now defined the Riemann, this zeta function over the whole complex plane, we ask ourselves the question, for which values s is the zeta function 0? And, well, here is kind of the complex plane, and let's look at some values of the Riemann function. Now, of course, for s equals 1, this sum diverges, and indeed the Riemann zeta function is infinite. And then, you know, and it's only infinite there. Now, it turns out with the analytical continuation, if you look at s equals 0, the Riemann function is 0 if s equals minus 2, minus 4, minus 6. For all, you know, maybe it is not for 0. Okay, let's forget about that. But for minus 2, minus 4, minus 6, minus 8, and so forth, for those values of s, the Riemann, the zeta function is 0, and those are considered the trivial zeros. It's straightforward to prove that that's the case, and so forth. So then all the other zeros of the Riemann, of the zeta function, lie in this strip, in this highway where the real component of S is between 0 and 1. But that's not so easy to prove. And when you kind of do calculations with this, you start to discover that actually all these zeros S lie on this critical line where the real component of S is a half. And there's this symmetry that, you know, a number, if S is a zero, then the complex conjugate of S is also zero. So that's kind of how that's how it looks like. And this is called the critical line. And the Riemann hypothesis, as most of you will probably know, is the statement that it is in fact true that all the non-trivial zeros of the zeta function lie on this line. And we think that that's true, and we don't have a proof of this. And proving this is a big thing. Now, why is this a big deal? Not so easy to explain, but you can kind of smell that there's something going on involving prime numbers by looking at what is called the Euler product, namely that this sum with which we started, that you can decompose that also as an infinite product over primes. So now you see that, knowing properties about this zeta function will tell you things about the primes. And as an obvious first observation is, of course, that, well, the fact that the zeta at S equals 1 it is infinity, namely the fact that this sum diverges, now has to mean that also this product diverges. And so that indicates right off the bat that there must be an infinite number of primes. Not very shocking, but you can read it from the zeta function. So the fact that over here, the zeta function goes to infinity means that there's an infinite number of primes. And actually, it's slightly stronger than that, namely that this product diverges, which means that there has to be a certain density of the primes. So that's kind of a naive kind of zero order conclusion that you can draw from the zeta function. It turns out if you know for sure that all the zeros lie on this critical line, then you reach very detailed information about the distribution of the primes, the density. Now, because of this relevance and because of this, the fact that this has been an open problem for quite a while, this is one of the seven millennium problems of the Clay Mathematical Institute. And it's important to note that you get $9 for a proof, but you do not get any money for a disproof. This is because, I mean, when you think of it, like it's of course, like it's possible that there is a disproof. Well, what is a disproof? A disproof would just be, you know, finding a zero that is off the critical line. But then, you know, well, they're not going to award somebody who just got extremely lucky with like a kind of computer search. So there you go. So still, the value of that in terms of tenure track money salary is probably still worth $1 million over the long term. So it's kind of nice to see that they actually kind of thought this through, that, you know, they don't want to award people who just got lucky.
But conceivably, somebody could prove that there existed a non-trivial zero off the line by some incredible argument.
Yeah, they would
locate.
Yeah,
they get the prize.
No, they would be very unlucky.
I think there's a jury that has the option to award the prize.
Yeah, that seems to be the case with everything involved in the Clay Institute. They just said, "Oh, I've got a jury, you want to get nothing on paper." It's probably pricey. And so this hypothesis has been tested for millions and billions of these zeros, and it holds. Now, to most of us, this would be good enough. Like, if it is, like, in the sense that, if you test it for billions of values, then, you know, it's kind of true. But number theory, I mean, mentally. I mean, of course, you're not claiming that you've got to prove them, but mentally. But number theory is one of those things where, actually, yes, you do have conjectures that hold for millions and billions, but then for even larger numbers, it goes wrong. Like, unlike, you know, the induction that you teach, you know, at an undergraduate course, you know, discrete mathematics, that if it holds for five, you know, consecutive numbers, it's going to hold, most likely. You have to be a little bit more careful. I mean, historically, there are cases of conjectures that held up to such a degree, yet they broke down at larger numbers. Indeed, where the setting also happens that no explicit counterexample is found, but a very detailed proof that a counterexample does exist in the link. So this is not entirely, non-mathematicians will believe in the Riemann hypothesis because of that large number there. Non-mathematicians believe in the Riemann hypothesis for very different reasons. And so when you read the description of the Riemann hypothesis on the website of the Clay Institute, you'll notice that they spend little, if any, kind of text on the fact that it has been verified. They will explain how this fits into a much larger framework in number theory and algebraic geometry. That's more convincing to those who actually work in the field. Now, for those of you who don't work in the field, there's been a search of books of a conjecture that has not been proven. Typically, these things happen when it has been proven. So maybe those people were anticipating that it was going to be proven soon. That's not the case. There's a book by Dan Rockmore. There's a book by Carl Savage. There's a book by Martin Statoy at Oxford. And there's a book by John Derbyshire. And this is really the past like 3 years. And I know from Dan Rockmore that he was somewhat displeased by the fact that his book was going to be one of many. He didn't know that it was going to be like part of such a big flock. And the reason why these books have been written now and not like 20 years ago, it probably has to do with the Millennium Prize, but also that there have been some kind of exciting developments involving potential ways of proving the Riemann hypothesis. And this is the spectral approach. And then this is really kind of beautiful stuff, and so makes for great popular works. And so now I'm going to explain a little bit what this spectral approach is in the case of the Riemann zeta. So when you look at this, I'm going to assume that the Riemann hypothesis is true, and I'm going to worry about how I'm going to prove this thing. And so here are a bunch of the first zeros, non-trivial zeros. And so the first value is actually pretty high. It's like 14.13. It's a complex component of 21, 25, 30. Now, of course, this is a small number of instances, but you could argue that you already start to see that they kind of start to cluster as you go up and as you go down. That the density is not uniformly distributed. And that's correct. You can prove that the absolute value of your imaginary component gets bigger, the density of those zeros is going to be higher. And how this density kind of changes is well understood. And so now what we do is the following: we look at we start counting here, we start like listing those zeros, and we look. Assuming the Riemann hypothesis is true, we are worried now about this gamma n, which is the component on the in the imaginary direction. And as these things get closer and closer to each other, we kind of normalize. We now start to look at the distance between gamma n and gamma n plus one, like how far away they are from each other, and we have to normalize this by multiplying. This naive distance by this log term. So by doing this, the expected distance normalized distance will be 1. So if you kind of have this kind of spacing parameter, the expected distance between two consecutive zeros is 1. And then you can ask, well, that's expected. That's in the limit if you count more and more zeros. But what happens sometimes it will be they will be a little bit closer. Sometimes they will be a little bit further away. How does that how are they rigidly kind of distributed, or is it completely random? And so people looked into this. And this is resulted.
Is this known that delta n goes to 1?
Like this, yes. Yeah.
So for larger n, it's approaching 1, or is it fluctuating?
So for each n the delta will be different. But as you kind of go higher and higher in the complex plane, the average delta will be one. Yes. And so what people looked into is like knowing this fact, you know, what is the standard deviation, if you want, between, you know, the deltas. And because there is an infinite number of zeros to consider, you can do all sorts of, you know, statistics and so forth, because you just have a sample that never ends. And so what Montgomery kind of observed, and what Dyson kind of explained to Montgomery afterwards, is that these deltas, these distances, are not Poisson, in the sense that they, you know, they're like a Poisson distribution. So what you will see is, when you do this, when you kind of collect the statistics, is that the average delta is 1. So now you can think like, okay, well, sometimes it's a half, sometimes it's 2, sometimes it's a quarter, sometimes, you know, that it's kind of some kind of Poisson distribution. But that's not the case. The spacing is kind of more regular than you would naively expect. And so what you see here is, as it were, the deltas that are possible, the deltas between, you know, two consecutive zeros. And here then is the probability that such a delta happens, and you collect, you know, millions and billions of these zeros, and you kind of plot that statistics. And so a Poisson distribution, which is what you maybe would maybe expect, would go like this. But instead, you get it like this. So of course, you know, the highest point is around 1. That's kind of, you know, the expected distance. And, you know, sometimes it's bigger, sometimes it's smaller, but it's not so often that it is really small. And really, really small actually hardly ever happens. So what this means is just that these gammas never get very close to each other. They repel each other. So the statistics of these zeros obey some kind of law that Dyson recognized as being the same kind of law, statistical law, that you see in random Hermitian matrices. If you take a random Hermitian matrix, so where random is defined that this, the measure is invariant under unitary transformation. If you take a random Hermitian matrix and you look at the spectra, then, and you would collect, you know, the statistics of those spectra, you will see the same kind of distribution. And that is a function you can kind of, you know, calculate what it is using random matrix theory, and it's very typical for, you know, having this unitary invariant measure on the Hermitian matrices. If you would have another kind of, rather than unitary operations, if you would have just orthogonal rotations, you would get a slightly different distribution. So this is kind of well recognized, you know, as being corresponding to the statistics of random Hermitian matrices. But there is no obvious reason why what the zeta function has to do anything with random Hermitian matrices. Yet the confirmation of these statistics is overwhelming. I mean, so let me explain again what you're seeing here. You're seeing here a line which is the prediction from random matrix theory, and you're seeing the dots, which are the statistics of the Riemann zeta function as calculated by Odysseus. And so this is quite a surprise. And so now we have the conjecture, not only the Riemann conjecture, we have also now the conjecture that, you know, these statistics are that you know, what we're seeing here, that this is significant. Now you look at it and you think, well, this has got to be significant. But you don't know what it means. Yes?
Does the curve for the spacings for GUE matrices, does that depend on the dimension of the matrix? And is that the asymptotic?
Yes, you go to infinite dimension Hermitian matrices, yes. Yeah, because otherwise things stop making sense.
Is it a specific model? You choose a specific potential? Is it one matrix?
The Riemann function or the continuous line, as it were.
The Hermitian matrix model.
So For a fixed dimension, what you would do is you look at the space of Hermitian matrices, you normalize it so that the spectrum kind of, you know, the typical distance between the eigenvalues is one. And then you take that measure that is invariant under unitary transformations, and then you get your statistics. As sampling from this measure on the Hermitian matrices, you look at those statistics between two consecutive eigenvalues. Then you get that.
It's like average over the measure, right?
Yes.
You choose one matrix, you look at all of its eigenvalues and the spacings of those, and then with high probability, that's close to this.
Yeah, I think you can also just say you look at. Well, no. You would have to sample the matrices over and over again. And that's how you collect your statistics.
So I think there's two effects. One is that the curve is actually an average over the measure. Uh-huh. And then what you have is also this concentration measure effect, that individual matrices would actually have spacings that would fit the curve with a very small error.
Mm-hmm.
So, and especially in the case of the infinite dimensional matrix, I assume that must be somehow exact, although I've never seen a concentration measure result proved for the infinite dimensional case. But that's actually an interesting distinction based on whether.
Okay, it never struck to me that those two things could be different. But that's my fault.
So I know for a finite dimensional case, if you just construct a random GUE matrix, a single instance for a fixed dimension, then you get something, you know, within some statistical error of that curve. And then by averaging over samples, you get the exact.
Uh-huh.
But in the infinite dimensional case, I don't know. I wonder about that. If a single instance would be exactly that curve because you have infinite statistics already.
I think it's safer to assume that they just sample many matrices and kind of collect that you get your statistics that way.
In any case, it's an analytic result, isn't it?
Yes. This is where hand waving comes in handy. It's one of those. Maybe it's one of those. So this observation that there seems to be this that the statistics of the zeta function corresponds to the statistics seem to correspond to the statistics of random Hermitian matrices, properly defined, kind of reinvigorated. Approach to trying to prove the Riemann hypothesis that goes back to Hilbert and Polya, although it's not entirely clear why it is called the Hilbert-Polya approach. It's an example of, if you're famous enough, people will give you credit for things you even didn't. So there's nothing on record saying that Hilbert or Polya kind of worked on this spectral approach and they were thinking about the Riemann hypothesis. There is a letter to Polya asking him if he can remember ever having thought about the spectral approach, and if he had an idea why this approach was named after him. Polya pretty much replying, "I have no idea. I might have said it in one sentence once to somebody." So, but nevertheless, it's called the Hilbert-Polya approach, and the Hilbert-Polya approach tries to kind of prove the Riemann hypothesis by finding a way of interpreting those non-trivial zeros as the spectrum of a Hermitian operator. Now, of course, you know, the spectrum of Hermitian operators are real valued, so you have to kind of take that, like, that critical line and like shift it by half and then rotate it, and then, you know, it's a real line. But I mean, the Riemann hypothesis says that those zeros lie on a line, and of course the eigenvalues of a Hermitian operator lie on a line as well. And the idea is that if you would be fortunate enough to find a Hermitian operator for which, you know, the equivalent of the characteristic polynomial which you would have for a finite dimensional matrix is the Riemann zeta function, then you're done. Because then, by the mere fact that it's an Hermitian operator, you know that the eigenvalues are on a line, and you've proven the Riemann hypothesis. So by being kind of, you know, you hope that you're kind of, you hope that you're lucky, that you can find, that you can think about it in this kind of Hermitian way. And so this, of course, this approach for what it's worth, predates these results by Odlisko and so forth, which are much more recent. But these random matrix statistics that we saw on the previous slide, that tells us that, well, this Hermitian operator will have to be able to reproduce the statistics that we're seeing, which are these random matrix. So now we know a little bit more about this operator that we want to find, namely that it has to have the same properties as a pseudo-random operator. Otherwise, you will not get those statistics back. And so this then, you know, you can cross off a lot of potential Hermitian operators because they don't obey those statistics, and you focus then on the ones that do. Of course, there are an infinite number of them. And so then the next kind of way of getting some kind of intuition at work is to note that such operators with such statistics occur naturally when in the study of chaotic quantum mechanical systems. So when you look at, you know, the spectra of chaotic quantum mechanical systems, then you'll see exactly that kind of eigenvalue repulsion that the Riemann zeta function has. So now it's somewhat of a leap of faith, but you know, if you don't know how to prove things, you'll end up doing strange things. Is that why physics? Like nobody ordered physics. Why would that help? The reason why people think that it might actually be a good idea to use some quantum physics here is that it's one thing to talk about Hermitian operators. If you allow yourself to think of those operators in terms of quantum mechanical systems, you can use a lot of intuition that you have, a lot of results that people have about those operators that occur in quantum mechanics. So, and that all those books that I mentioned a few slides ago, they all talk about how now people are looking at, you know, trying to find proper quantum mechanical, chaotic quantum mechanical systems whose spectra obey the same kind of statistics as the zeta function. And of course, the zeta function is only one zeta function. So what the goal is to kind of find the right kind of quantum mechanical system such that its spectra is exactly the Riemann zeta function, thereby proving the Riemann hypothesis. So that's the hope. And that's what people are working on. And so that's the spectral approach. And I do not at all work on this at all. Okay, so just be clear. But this is the setting. This is kind of what, you know, is a well-established, you know, line of research, and it's very exciting. And you know, who knows, maybe people will manage to kind of bring it to completion. Now, this is all about the Riemann hypothesis, which is a statement about the Riemann zeta function. But the truth of the matter is that besides the Riemann zeta function, there are lots of other zeta functions. And I'll kind of give you a flavor of how that works. So the Riemann zeta function deals, you know, with integers and with primes. And there's this way of, like, you've got the sum of the integers, and then it devolves into this product of the primes. And a slightly more algebraic way of phrasing this is that, well, you're dealing with a ring of integers Z, and you have the ideals in this ring, nZ, which are, you know, where n is any integer value. And you've got the prime ideals pz. And so the fact that, you know, every integer can be formed as a product, there's a unique way of describing every integer as a product of primes, is similar to saying that every ideal in the ring z can be composed out of the prime ideals pz. That's the same statement. But if you phrase it like that, then you can also do it for other rings. So you can also look at the ring, you know, of the Gaussian integers over here, or the integers that are, you know, integer combinations of 1 and the cube root of 1. These are called the Eisenstein integers. So these all are rings. These all have ideals. These all have prime ideals. They work differently. And using the same kind of machinery, you can also define zeta functions for integers, structures, rings like that. And for those, you can also formulate a corresponding Riemann hypothesis. And that, you know, Riemann hypothesis holds for also these kind of more general rings is called the extended Riemann hypothesis. Also not been proven at all. This is also not what I work on. What I do work on is that another way, another kind of important way of defining rings is by looking at polynomial equations. So this is a polynomial equation over a finite field Fp in n variables, modulo a set of polynomial equations, again, over a finite field in n variables. We will not see this reoccurring again in future slides, but this is just kind of showing that, well, for those of you who are kind of who like this kind of stuff, like, you know, these things are rings. This is a ring. You can do the same kind of stuff, like what are its ideals, what are its prime ideals, and you can get, again, formulate a zeta function and wonder what the corresponding Riemann conjecture, Riemann hypothesis would be for this kind of new zeta function. And in this setting, we think like, well, that's not all as nice as integers. This setting, things have been proven. Things have been conjectured, and things have been proven. So although this was developed way after the original Riemann zeta function, the results that we have for these kinds of zeta functions is much better.
Sorry. So these zeta functions then could talk about the geometry of general regularity?
Yes. So it's a way of talking about the algebraic variety that is defined by the zeros of, you know, this set of equations. We typically, you know, you think of one function f. So if it's an f in function f in two variables, we define a curve. If it's in more variables, we define a hypersurface. And so, it's the usual algebraic geometry kind of thing that you want to talk about the geometric structure that is, you know, the variety of the solutions to these polynomial equations. And and you do it by talking about this ring.
Right, so the zeta function encodes what exactly?
Sorry?
The zeta function encodes what exactly?
It implicitly encodes, you know, what are the prime ideals in this, and what are the ideals, and how does it all work out. But as you'll see in the next slide, it has a very different way of, you can phrase it in such that it describes how many solutions are there to equations of this kind. So actually, it ties in extremely, in a very nice way to counting solutions of polynomial equations of finite fields, which is why it is such a beautiful piece of math. Okay. So what we're doing here is some kind of inspired guessing. On the one hand, we've got the integers, we've got the Riemann zeta function, and we've got the zero of the zeta function. And on the other hand, we have, you know, equations over finite fields that, you know, somehow will allow us to define also something which you can consider a zeta function, well, which is a zeta function of, you know, this other system. And then you can look at the zeros of this zeta function. And we know that on the right we have the Riemann hypothesis, which we believe to be true. So on the left, we're also going to assume that there is a similar kind of thing as the Riemann hypothesis for these zeta functions. This was conjectured by André Weil, and so this has the slightly odd name Weil's Riemann hypothesis. And for every function f, there is a different zeta function, and so for every function f, there is a new hypothesis. So Weil has like a whole bunch of hypotheses. And then there is this missing gap because we don't know how to prove them. But as I said, in this case, with these finite field equations, there is a proof. And this is proven by Delin in the 74, which is generally considered one of the highlights of mathematics of the past 100 years. Anybody working in coding theory knows that this result by Delin, which kind of gives very strict bounds on how many solutions there can be to a finite field equation, is used all over the place. This is not only a very kind of beautiful result in the sense that it completes, you know, the Riemann hypothesis in a different setting. It's just extremely useful for finite field calculations. So you got the field smell of work in 1974.
Is that how it looks like in 74?
I think so.
Doesn't look like it.
Does it look like it? I took it from the He looks differently now. That's me. Yes. And so, when you ask a mathematician, why do you believe the Riemann hypothesis is true, they will say, because it has been proven in this case. And therefore, it should also hold. Like there's such a kind of nice symmetry, it must hold. Of course, people have not been able to reproduce that proof on the other side, otherwise we would have proven the Riemann hypothesis. Now, what we saw in the case of the standard, you know, the Riemann, the zeta function, is that we have this kind of dream, this pink cloud, that maybe with a spectral approach we can, you know, reach the Riemann hypothesis, prove the Riemann hypothesis. Now, here, for finite field equations, we know that the Riemann hypothesis is true, but the proof of the Riemann hypothesis, the one by Deligne, does not use quantum mechanics at all. It uses something, it uses a kind of spectral theory, but it's not the spectral theory that you and I work on when we do quantum mechanics. It's a very different spectral theory. But there are already kind of like little snippets of, you know, at least that a spectral approach might be possible. But what I want is a quantum mechanical kind of way of proving this. So what I want is to kind of make this connection between, you know, these zeta functions and their Riemann hypothesis using quantum mechanics, inspired by the fact that other people are working on it in the case of the Riemann zeta function. And the question is this possible? Does this make sense? So I'm going to argue now for a while that this makes sense. And then, you know, and then that's it, because I don't have that proof. I don't have the general proof. I've proven it for certain equations, but not for all equations. So this is what I just said. And what we want to have is spectral, like a quantum mechanical spectral interpretation of the zeta functions of finite field equations using ideas from quantum computing. And as a side benefit would be that you would have end up with quantum algorithms. Yes.
So you're switching from Hermitian matrices to unitary ones.
Yes.
And actually, I was wondering earlier when you made the claim about the infinite dimensional case, isn't the spacing distribution for a random unitary the same as that for a random Hermitian operator in infinite dimension? So
probably. I mean, of course, you know, they lie on the line inverse, they lie on a circle. But probably if you take a little snippet of the circle, you can view it as a straight line. Undoubtedly. I mean, I've tried reading the books on random matrix theory. I kind of
Well, I think the spacings are the same, but whether or not you can get the same mapping between the eigenvalues of the matrix and the zeros is not obvious to me.
No, but, I mean, but it turns out that there is such a phenomenon also happening for these zero functions or finite field equations. Same kind of statistical behavior. Okay. I will be working over curves that are defined over a finite field, Fp, and its extensions. Okay. So this is, you know, if you've got a finite field, Fp, then, you know, that lies in a bigger finite field, Fp squared, which lies in a bigger finite field, Fp to the power 4. But Fp squared also lies in Fp6, but Fp4 does not lie in Fp6. And so it all has to do with, like, do those powers, you know, divide each other or not? So the general idea is that you start off with a finite field, and there are, you know, there's a standard way of kind of viewing that as being part of a bigger and bigger finite field. So that's, and then, you know, the closure, if you kind of like complete this, then you have the algebraic closure of the finite field, which is no longer a finite field. And those of you not familiar with finite fields, this is like, here are the reals, and here you've got like a complex number. Reals lie in a complex number. Except for then you're kind of done, because this is kind of a more complicated structure. And whenever you have a polynomial equation defined over a finite field Fp, you can consider it, you know, its solutions in Fp, but also in its extension. Just as if you have a real, you know, if you have a polynomial with real coefficients, you can consider its solutions in the complex plane. And so, as you know, these finite fields get bigger, like get you know, more and more general, there will be more and more solutions to the same kind of equation. And what we want to do is, given a a polynomial equation, we want to know, you know, how many solutions are there when the entries are in FP? How many solutions are there when the entries are in FP squared and so forth? And how does that occur? And from now on, I will just look at kind of the most simple non-trivial case where F is just a single polynomial which is in two variables, so now it just defines a curve. So this could be, you know, y squared equals x to the power t plus 2. And you look at the solutions x, y to that equation. And that's then a curve. And the beauty of algebraic geometry is that although this is defined over a finite field, you know, which you think of as a very discrete kind of structure, you can use all sorts of ideas that you would get from looking at these equations over the complex plane. So you can think of them as manifolds, you can think of them as having a genus, you can also, you can do topology with those things, but not in an obvious way, but you can. So let me just define what the zeta function is for a finite field equation. I've got a polynomial equation f, and I want to count the number of solutions as, you know, the entries x are from a finite field Fp for one of its extensions. So I introduce this number n of s, which is how many solutions does my polynomial equation have when the entries are restricted to the extension of degree s of the finite field. Okay. So typically you think of n1 as being, you know, how many solutions there are. But it also makes perfect sense to talk about n2, n3, n4. And because, you know, this gets bigger and bigger, this number will grow and grow. So given one polynomial equation, there is a sequence of these integers n, which encode, you know, how many solutions are there to this polynomial equation. And then, for reasons that we will skip, the zeta function of this polynomial equation is the formal exponential function of the infinite sum of, you know, those numbers divided by s, where s is, of course, from 1 to infinity, and a formal variable t to the power s. So this is an infinite sum. This is an infinite sum. It looks like a big mess, but it works out very nicely. So for each function f, you have this expression. So for each, so if you want to know the zeta function, one way of doing it is figuring out, well, how does this number grow for a given polynomial equation? You do the math, and then you look at what is the zeta function. And to count the number of solutions, you also have to count the points at infinity to make it all work nicely.
How is this exponential? How was this derived? Or why was this a good choice?
It's not right. So remember that with the original Riemann zeta function, what you have was this infinite sum over the integers equals, then works out to be equal to the product of primes. Now, what you have to do is you have to kind of, you know, you get a little bit French. You start to abstract the things. So now, okay, like, well, it's a ring. So now we want to, we make this, we, and now we define, you know, so it has ideals, which we think of as what were the integers or each other. And then you define the norm on the ideals. And then what you say is, well, my new zeta function is going to be the infinite sum over all the ideals in the ring that is, you know, set of polynomials modulo a specific polynomial that we're dealing with. And if you do that, then, you know, you have one infinite sum. But then you kind of start cranking, you know, well, what are the sizes of these ideals in this new ring that we're dealing with? And then, lo and behold, you end up with this double exponential expression. So when you would re-express this completely in terms of, you know, a ring and its ideals and its prime ideals, you would get exactly the same kind of expression as the original Riemann zeta function does. So sort of, I mean, there's some serious rewriting going on to reach that that description. So what is the zeta function of a straight line? Straight line x plus y equals 0 in, you know, some type of field. Well, number of solutions is this. Turns out the zeta function, despite being a double infinite sum, is this fraction. 1 over 1 minus t, 1 minus pt. So it doesn't have any zeros, but it does have two poles. It has a pole at t equals 1, and it has a pole at t equals 1 over p. And for all straight lines, they will have this zeta function. This is more convincing if I go over it faster than in the details. Take a quartic curve, x to the power 4 plus y to the power 4 plus 1 equals 0. What is the zeta function of that? Well, it's a little bit more, and now we're doing it over f5. It's 1 minus t, 1 minus 5t. So again, we have two poles, one at t equals 1, one at t equals 1 over p. But now there's this non-trivial part in the top, and then those are the zeros of the zeta function. And when you analyze it, then you see that, well, these trivial poles are mentioned, but the non-trivial zeros, or the non-trivial roots, happen at t equals and t equals. And the absolute value of these non-trivial roots is 1 over the square root of p, 1 over the square root of 5. And as a result, the number of solutions of this equation of extension, of finite field of extension degree s, will be this, you know, 5 to the power s plus 1 to the power s minus this term to the power s minus this term to the power s. So what is important is that the non-trivial zeros have absolute norm, which is kind of 1 over the square root of p, and that, well, you know, they are the complex conjugate selection. Let's do a cubic equation. Again, over f5, we see again, you know, that the non-trivial zeros are, you know, two expressions which are the complex conjugates of each other, where the norm is again the square root of 1 over square root. The norm of the zeros is 1 over the square root of p. So get this expression. And if you take another cubic curve, then all of a sudden it doesn't hold. It doesn't hold. Now something went wrong. Why is this? This is kind of annoying at first glance, but this is because this defines a curve that is smooth, has all the right, you know, properties, and this is a curve, a cubic curve that is non-smooth. So these are some kind of technical things that we don't want to worry about too much at first glance. But so it holds, the Riemann-Weyl's version of the Riemann hypothesis holds for smooth curves, not for all. And, okay, well, you should at least see this. This is the Riemann hypothesis that we have for finite field equations, for curves. Every some kind of polynomial function defining a curve with the right properties, and the zeta function of this curve is, you know, this fraction where pt is some kind of polynomial. These are the two trivial kind of poles. And then pt is this polynomial, which is just a product of these, of course, these expressions. And then the Riemann hypothesis says that all these alphas have absolute norm square root of p. So all the zeros have norm 1 over square root of p. And those complex values, alpha j, come in pairs, that they always come in. If 1 is part of it, then complex conjugate is also. And this is the Riemann hypothesis for curves, and, you know, it may not sound, you know, very juicy at first glance, but this we know how to prove, and it also allows us a very general expression for the number of solutions of these finite fields. So, you know, it's dominated by p to the power s, then there's this point at infinity, and then you have those additional terms, and they have norm the square root of p. So this gives a very tight bound on how many solutions a finite field equation can have, which is why it's used in arithmetic curves. And how many of these alphas are there? Well, it's 2g of those alphas are there, where g is the genus of the curve. So there's some kind of topological information encoded in this function. So what is the idea? The idea is that in the Riemann zeta function, we have this spectrum which was lying on a line, and that's statistics of annular emission matrices. And we want to find, you know, a quantum mechanical Hamiltonian that reproduces this this spectrum. The idea for these other zeta functions of a finite field equations is that we know for a fact that the roots of these zeta functions are, you know, described by these terms alpha j, which have an absolute value square root of t, and then the only thing that is kind of unknown are these phases. So given that you know this norm, you can kind of ignore it, there's no interesting information. So for each finite field equation, there is a zeta function, and the zeta function, it's kind of, you know, it's interesting information, is described by these phases, you know, phi 1, phi 2, up to phi 2g, where g is the genus of the curve. So you can think of, it's not tempting to start to think of these eigenvalues as lying on a unit circle in the complex plane, which is exactly the spectrum of a unitary transformation. So the standard case Hermitian matrices, this different kind of way of defining zeta functions, they are unitary matrices, and the eigenvalues lie on a circle. What are the arguments in favor of, you know, having a quantum mechanical interpretation of the spectra of those zeta functions with finite field equations? Well, I mentioned that the statistics of the Riemann zeta function are, you know, those of random emission matrices. When we study the statistics of those finite field equation zeta functions, then, lo and behold, the statistics of random unitary matrices come. So the same kind of thing happens. And there are two like results that are important. There is something called the Sutter-Tate conjecture for elliptic curves, which very recently has been kind of proven by Taylor at Harvard, where, you know, for an elliptic curve where genus is one, we're talking about random SU2 matrices, that indeed for elliptic curves, you see that you can prove that the statistics of the zeta functions are those of random SU2 matrices. This has been open conjecture, and it seems that it's kind of proven now. Another result by Katz and Sarnak of a few years ago is that if you take curves, you know, with very high genus, very complicated curves, you let the finite field p go to infinity, then again you can prove that so everything, you know, what is conjectured for the Riemann zeta function, we can prove in this new scenario that indeed statistics are those of random unitary matrices. So again, the same things hold, except for now we can prove them, and some of these proofs are extremely recent. I probably should find a way of wrapping this up.
What is USP?
It's the combination of unitary matrices and that are asymplectic, because remember that for each eigenvalue, the complex conjugate has to be part of it as well. So you cannot just take any unitary matrix. You have to kind of impose this restriction. And then you end up with this group. It's not a particularly well, I ripped this off the article. I have proof. It's not a group that one deals with something next. And so, okay, I guess I can let this be the one but last slide. So there is a kind of, this is kind of a slippery business what I'm doing here, because all I'm saying here is that, wherever there is a random unitary, whenever there's like a random unitary matrix, this has to do with quantum mechanics. But of course, this is not necessary. So, I mean, you can have random unitary matrices that have nothing to do with quantum mechanics. And so in the case of the Riemann zeta function, this is kind of, you know, it's you could say it's kind of dubious to think that quantum mechanics has to do with something to do with the Riemann zeta function, because, well, maybe it's just random matrix theory. There's no quantum mechanics lying around. Now, in this new, in this other setting with these finite field equations, we have all those things proven. We have proven that the Riemann hypothesis holds, and we have proven that the statistics will often obey these random matrix these random matrix properties. So what does it mean that I say it has something to do with quantum mechanics? I mean, so yeah, of course, I mean, they lie on a circle. Of course, I can make a unitary matrix that has that as a spectrum. It seems to become a void state. To tie it in with quantum mechanics, you can say, like, well, according to quantum mechanics, according to the theory of quantum computing, not all unitaries are the same. There are those that can be made efficiently, which you can consider like natural occurring unitary matrices. And you can have unitary matrices that are very hard to make. And that, of course, is, you know, the vast majority of unitary matrices. And so a way of thinking about this, to make a distinction between what is random matrix theory and what is, you know, the quantum mechanical component of random matrix theory, the conjecture would be that the spectra of these zeta functions can be reproduced by quantum mechanical systems, where a quantum mechanical system is defined as an efficient quantum circuit. I mean, we can always make it, but if you put on the restriction that it has to be an efficient quantum circuit, it becomes a non-trivial statement, given that we already know that, you know, the eigenvalues lie on the circle. So I can do that for certain functions. What would it do? Like, what good does this do? Well, if you can prove this, you would strengthen the connection between quantum mechanics and number theory, something that many people suspect. So the idea would be, you know, given a finite field equation, build me a circuit which has the right spectrum. So, you know, we would be helping out people in number theory, but what is it in it for us who work in quantum computing? The side benefit of being able to make such circuits is that by doing trace estimation on the unitary transformations, you can estimate the number of solutions of the finite field equation. So there's actually an algorithmic benefit to being able to make those circuits. And which is different from a recent result by Catlaya, which does an exact counting algorithm for curves with low genes. Let me just show the equations that we know how to solve. We know how to make those circuits for equations which are of the following kinds. They're called Fermat-Hertz surfaces and certain cases of the elliptic or of elliptic curve. Those we know how to do. For other ones, we do not know how to do it. So that's still an open a problem to kind of make this work for other curves.
Polylog G.
Polylog G, yes. So this is indeed something that I went over too fast, but there are 2G eigenvalues, so the dimension of the quantum circuit has to be 2G, so the number of qubits involved would be a log G. Okay. And so this is still open research to kind of make this work for other curves. And I guess I'll leave it at that. Okay, thank you.
So you mentioned the quantum Turing thesis, but so why would you expect does nature somehow compute these roots of that's a quantum Turing thesis. Well, why is that? Like, why did you conjecture that apart from
I mean, what you want to do is be able to make a distinction between random matrices that are just random matrices and random matrices that are random matrices that occur in nature, whatever that means, that can really occur, you know, out there.
Why do you expect these to occur in nature?
Otherwise, there is nothing to conjecture. I mean, we already know that there are a spectra of random unitary matrices, so there's no contribution. And in part, when people try to solve the Riemann hypothesis in the original case, they really are thinking about very specific kind of quantum billiards, which will have, you know, the right spectral properties. So, you know, on the other side, people are thinking about very explicit quantum mechanical systems. So the only fair thing for me to do would be also to look at very specific quantum mechanical systems. But now, because it's finite dimensional and unitary, I think quantum circuits.
In the case, I understand the use of the term random in the sentence that solutions are given by the eigenvalues of random unitary matrices, because it's just some unitary matrix. In what sense is it random?
One thing that you can do is one thing is that what the subtle Tate conjecture says is that you have a specific cubic, you know, equation, something like this, and then you say, well, let's interpret this in F2. So now it's an equation over modulo 2 value. But the same equation can also be interpreted in F5, can be interpreted in, you know, any prime p. Now, what you can do for each, you know, prime field, you get a different zeta function. So although you have one equation, you'll have an infinite set of zeta functions, and then you can take the statistics of that. What Katz and Sarnak do is they say, fix the prime p, fix the genus g, consider all functions with this genus. So they kind of, in the case of elliptic curves, they fix the finite field p, and then they do all elliptic curves of this finite field at p. So they take their statistics in a different direction.
I want to hog all the questions, but this result is strong because it's not just the nearest neighbor spacings, but the full distribution, which includes other correlations between next and nearest. Have they done statistical tests in infinite dimensional case that the zeros are distributed according to a broader spectrum of statistical tests than just the nearest neighbor?
Okay, that's you mean in the Riemann
process?
Yes. So the stuff that I said, it didn't come to. So it's one thing to talk about these statistics of random matrices. I was very overly ambitious, yes. So when you look at the zeros of the Riemann zeta function, this is actually really good stuff. That if you look at the statistics of the Riemann zeta function, then you know, you look at the correlation between two individual eigenvalues, it will base those statistics of that curve that I showed you earlier, the Dyson and Montgomery Odlyski curve. But you can also look at, you know, correlations between three eigenvalues, four eigenvalues, and so forth and so on. And so then you're really kind of starting to kind of really test the conjecture that has to do with random matrices. And what you see is that, you know, so what you have here on the x-axis is, you know, effectively how many eigenvalues are you considering, and on the y-axis you've got some kind of, you know, correlation function between those. And then what you have here are the dots are the Riemann zeta function. This dotted line is some kind of set of Hermitian matrices that have the wrong kind of measure. The other dotted line here is the Hermitian matrices statistics. And so, you know, this is over here, this is what, you know, what Lisko and so forth tested. But what he also tested, Lisko, credit to him, was, well, these higher correlations. And then you see that they start diverging. And that's, well, that's kind of interesting. You think, like, okay, well, maybe, you know, it's this second order degree, you know, thing that goes wrong. But actually, so this is the same graph, but now here L, the correlation goes between 1 and 2 eigenvalues. Here it's between 0 and 100 eigenvalues. That actually, this curve goes haywire for larger and larger correlations. It goes up and down and up and down. And so this is not at all GUI behavior at all. Like on this graph, it says the GUI graph is not shown because it's way off. So what Michael Berry was able to show using semi-classical methods to kind of calculate those higher order correlations that are no longer GUI, but using semi-classical methods, he managed to predict this for the Riemann zeta function. So whenever you're around Michael Berry, don't go off about GUI Hermitian matrices and the Riemann zeta function, because, you know, he points out, it's much more interesting than that. There is actually a connection between semi-classical methods that physicists use to work with quantum chaotic systems and the Riemann zeta function.
So if I understand this, it means that the zeros deviate in exactly the same way that physical systems deviate from the mathematical measure.
Yes. And the only thing, what Barry did to calculate this is, as I understand it, he used the trace formula, and he kind of conjectured what the periodic orbits were of the corresponding quantum system.
So what system is this on the right that Barry was using?
It's kind of, when you look at your spectrum and you have a large window, like as your window grows, you can expect more and more numbers, eigenvalues to appear in that window, right? And so because you normalize the spacing, that number is the expected number of eigenvalues in a window of length L is going to be L eigenvalues. Okay? But of course, sometimes there are more, sometimes there are less. This has to do with the fact that they kind of, you know, they don't quite line up, you know, as uniformly as is perfect. So what you do is you look at how does this vary? How does this is called the number variance. And so he did this here for windows that contain, you know, up to 100 eigenvalues. And then the variance that random matrix theory predicts is very different from the variance that you see in with the Riemann zeta function. But the same kind of number variance can be predicted using semi-classical methods.
So
what he uses, I mean, this is again, as I understand it, what he uses is that you can, you know, estimate these number variance statistics using, you know, what are the periodic orbits, what are some of the other properties of the quantum mechanical system, of the underlying classical system. So this is really assuming, you know, there's an underlying classical system, and you use that to predict the quantum mechanical spectrum.
That's a semi-classical.
Yes.
What is the Hamiltonian
from
which you started?
So I don't think, as I understand, he only assumed that the periodic orbits, the classical periodic orbits, were distributed as follows. I don't think that there's an explicit Hamiltonian there that he uses.
Right. So, but it's defined implicitly. It's some class Hamiltonians which have those orbits at some kind of fixed points or something like that.
Yeah. But it, I'll be honest with you. It's somewhat of a mystery to me to how he exactly gets these.
But this doesn't show this is not sort of higher order correlation functions. It's this variance in the number of eigenvalues.
Yes.
Okay, so maybe it's time to wrap things up. I'm just going to be here till the end of the week, leaving early Saturday.
Yeah.
So if you want to catch him later on this week. Thanks again.